air. Hi, Pauline.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Robert.
I am so delighted that you are in the studio with us and that you have made quite a trip to get here. I realize that, and I'm grateful for that. It is wonderful to have you in the studio. I'm going to read a little introduction, if I may. Pauline Ukmanowicz is a freelance writer in the Hudson Valley whose poems, essays, and reviews have appeared in Crazy Horse, The Massachusetts Review, Mudfish, Ohio Review, Plowshares, Radcliffe Quarterly, West Branch, Z Magazine, and elsewhere. She is the Associate Professor of English and Director of the Creative Writing at SUNY New Paltz. She is co-founder and series editor for the Cod Hill Poetry Award. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So we're going to focus on two topics today. One is your new book, Starfish, and the other is about your experiences teaching poetry. But before we jump into that, I'd like to ask you just a little bit more of a personal question. I'm very curious as to how you found poetry or how poetry found you.
Well, it's really interesting because I thought that we had an email exchange where I said I might talk about Emily Dickinson.
Oh, that's coming.
And so I dropped out of school and I went back, and these women I knew had a place for rent in this little carriage house, and I moved in.
No, when and where are we?
This
was
in Amherst, Massachusetts,
okay. Oh,
and it's 1976
okay.
or 7. I'm not sure when.
Okay.
Because I dropped out, you know. So anyway, unbeknownst to me, across the street was Emily Dickinson's homestead. So I used to walk to school, cut through the graveyard. And I was studying with a professor at the time whose name was Cynthia Griffin Wolfe, and she was a Dickinson scholar. And so one night I was with my friend in the graveyard, and there was this place over in the distance, and I said, I've always wanted to go there. Let's go. So I walked over, and it was Emily Dickinson's grave. And it was a family plot. We went in, we opened the gate. And there's her tombstone. It says, Emily Dickinson, born December 10th, 1830, called back. Don't remember the exact date, 1886.
Yeah, she was 56 when she
56.
Died.
56. Yeah, I told my teacher about it, and I said there was a tree, and it looked like it had been severed by lightning, and my teacher was, you know, kind of shaking because there was a poem, Nature Sometimes Sears a Sapling. So I guess standing on Emily Dickinson's grave at midnight in Amherst, Massachusetts, is kind of what did it. And studying.
Wow, that's a great story. So you started with Emily Dickinson? Did you start exploring her work then and there?
Yeah. And of course, I was majoring in English at the time, so I was reading other things too. Mm-hmm. So I also studied with someone named James Tate. He just died
recently.
Oh,
yes, he's a great poet.
At the time, the Norton Anthology went from Walt Whitman to James Tate, and I was too ignorant to even understand what that meant. And he was only 35 years old at the time, so it was really something.
He's an interesting poet in that he had such an interesting twist in using humor in his work.
Absolutely.
The absurdity, I guess, is a better way of saying it. But a really wonderful poet. Really
I love
wonderful.
His work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So can you give us or just share with us a couple other poets whose work you admire?
Oh, God. I get asked this all the time. I feel like it's always whomever I'm reading or teaching. Mm-hmm. So right now we're reading Ted Kooser. We're reading a young poet who won the Yale Yerger Poets Award a couple years ago. Her name is Ansel Elkins, very interesting poet. Billy Collins we're reading. Let's see, what else? A poet named Karina Barovich. Her book is called Proof. And then I assign hundreds of poems, lots of old-time favorites. I love Wisława Szymborska, Bill Knott, Charles Simic. I mean, I could just go on and on. Louise Glick.
That's a great list. You've hit on some of my favorites. So the Morgan Library does have a brand new exhibit that focuses on Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. And just prior to that, they did Jane Eyre and her sisters. Mm-hmm. And so you've been to the exhibit?
Yeah. Have you been to it?
Yes, I have. And since the last time we talked, I actually went down and saw
good.
It. So yeah, I wanted to get there before this conversation. Mm-hmm. So please tell me your take on it.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I think you can tell that because, you know, no one knew Emily Dickinson was going to be famous in her life. They didn't have much. But what they had was interesting. I was very interested in her handwriting. And what I noticed, Robert, there's always been this question about whether or not those dashes in her poetry was punctuation or handwriting. If you look at it closely, to me, it seems like it was deliberate. Well, she was a prolific letter writer, as you know. There were no dashes in her letters. There were no dashes in her handwriting. So this leads me to the conclusion that why are scholars debating this? I think the other thing that really struck me was, of course, you know, there's that new book out by...
is it Susan Howe?
Or no, not Susan Howe. I haven't read that yet, but it's by Marta Werder. She's a scholar. And Jen Bervin, he's an artist. And Emily Dickinson wrote on scraps of paper. She wrote on the back of envelopes. So they're called envelope poems. And there was a poem about a house written on a piece of paper that was shaped like a house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I found thrilling was, as we know, she only published 10 poems in her life. It's under debate. Some scholars say 7, some say as many as 15. But
they were altered, too, which is really perturbing.
They were altered, but there was the poem she published in the Springfield Republican. I think it's called, it's a Narrow Fellow in the Grass, the one, and they called it The Snake, which was not her title. But it was thrilling for me to see that poem in print. Mm-hmm. And interestingly about that poem, what she most objected to was they changed the dashes to a question mark, so they changed the punctuation. The punctuation completely changed the meaning of the poem.
Of course, yeah. And if I'm remembering correctly, a lot of her work stayed incorrect into the 1950s. And actually, it was only into the 1970s when people said, oh, wait a minute. And this may be because, of course, that she was a woman. But, you know, like, why are we treating these works with such disrespect? This is not how the poet intended this to be. I was struck by, I'm so happy you mentioned handwriting, because I don't know what happens to me. Maybe it's because I'm a visual artist and I like mark making, or I'm, you know, seduced by it. But I was really studying her writing. And I noticed her handwriting in college, all of her letters were more or less connected in each word. Later on in life, almost every letter is solo. Each letter is by itself. Even though it might be in script, it's still not connected to the letter before it or after it. And she used capital letters often, not at the beginning of the word or not at the beginning of just a sentence. Mm-hmm. And I was very moved by it. There was a delicacy, but also a kind of an elegance to her later handwriting.
I agree with you. And then there was a book that she had. I think they called it a herborium.
Yeah, without the plant samples.
Her flowers she had pressed, and the whole history of her publication is very interesting. So she did try to kind of self-publish because she made the fascicles, which she hole-punched, stitched with thread. When she died, her sister Lavinia found these. Her sister-in-law, Susan Dickinson, had a cachet because she had sent her letters. Mm-hmm. And, of course, her sister was living next door at Evergreens in her brother Aston's mansion. So at first, Lavinia let Susan try to publish these, but Susan really didn't have any luck. And ultimately, Mabel Loomis Todd, Austin's mistress, who had entree into the publishing world, she ended up publishing them, but she kind of seduced Lavinia because she had one of the first typewriters, and she had typed a few of these poems and showed them to Susan.
To Lavinia.
Yeah. But the interesting point about what you just said about tidying up, Emily Dickinson, when she was 31, writes to Thomas Higginson, who's, you know, the story, the editor of The Atlantic. He would never publish anything. Yet he published her poems after she died. The first bunch with Mabel Loomis Todd, no one would even know his name if it weren't for Emily Dickinson, ironically. But yes, then the Harvard, it's a Thomas Johnson edition in 1955. He set out to, as fairly as possible, publish the poems as she wrote them. And he tried to use what he felt was the most recent version of the poem. So the way it's laid out, they're numbered.
Oh, so they're also sequentially in order.
Well, actually, they're not necessarily sequential. He kind of followed the fascicles. So there's a circa number, a number if they were published. So he had a particular order to them. Mm-hmm. So that's still considered a definitive text, that 1955 complete works of Emily Dickinson.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath now.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Same thing happened to her. Until, I guess it was, he was about to die, and then he allowed the publishing of the poems in the order, in the sequence, in the punctuation with how mm-hmm. she originally wrote them. Mm-hmm. It's a strange parallel. I never thought about it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it goes on far too often. Well, let's talk a little bit about teaching. We're gonna get to Starfish, but so you run this creative writing center. So I'm curious about first of all, I guess this may sound like a ridiculous question to you, but can one really teach poetry?
Oh, God, you know, it's really interesting you're asking me this because I interviewed Tobias Wolff, and I asked the question. It was on the phone.
Uh-huh.
He wouldn't even answer. And then he was just like, next question.
He teaches poetry.
You know, he teaches fiction.
Ah.
But this is a question people always get. And, you know, people who had studied with him, in fact, kind of declared that he did teach them how to write better. I think that you can teach people certain strategies and techniques. And in fact, it's near the end of the semester. I am absolutely astonished by what my students have written this semester, what they started with. But they have to read a tremendous amount. They have to write 8 or 9 take-home assignments. They write a quarterly, a midterm, and a final portfolio with a critique.
Of their own work?
Okay. They participate in peer review 3 to 4 times, depending on the number of people in the class. And then you also have to be a lead reviewer. So if it's your poem, Robert, and I'm the lead reviewer, I have to dissect it. I have to use very deep technical vocabulary to explain what's happening in terms of poetics, prosody, talk about what it means. Talk about its tropes, its rhetorical figures, the catalog that it's using. And then students do, you know, by the end, they realize poetry is about images. That's what I say in the first day of class. It's about images. People frequently come to my office and say, all my friends tell me I'm a good poet. Will you read some of my poems? And I say, no, I don't want to, because I probably won't like them and I'll hurt your feelings. So then they insist, and I take the poem and I turn it over and I say, tell me a single image that's in your poem. And if they can't answer the question, I say, go to the library, read some books, write a poem with images in it, and bring it back to me, and then I will read it. So I think you can nurture what people have, and I'm not trying to make anyone write a certain way. Our goal is for every person in the class to develop and discover a poetic identity in terms of language and subject matter with a focus on the image.
So you're asking people to think pictorially, really. So what I'm curious about, this was on my list of questions, but now it has a new application, is the idea of modern technology and the influence it has on a younger student today. And then, because I worry that people are not going to be reflective enough in their thinking skills as they grow older and become adults and have to function and create out into the world, because we're always watching, we're always attached to something, we're always having dialogue with this device. And when's our downtime? When are we quiet? When are we alone? When are we wandering? When are we wandering? So how do you see all that in terms of modern technology and your group of students that are interested in poetry?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I have no idea how to answer this. I literally have a little flip phone. I brought it with me today. I learned how to text out of emergency when my 16-year-old niece was coming into Penn Station. And when I called her on the phone, she wouldn't answer. So I learned how to text on this flip phone. So I don't have a cell phone. I've never been on social media of any kind. I, of course, have to use email. But, you know, I just tell the students they have to check it at the door. And poetry is oral. It's auditory. And so, you know, they have to look at it on the page. They have to read it out loud. When you teach English, especially if you're teaching like 17th century or 18th century literature, it's easy to say, no one had a cell phone. You need to read this on the page. I don't know. Students who study English and study poetry and are writers, they are very invested in reading and writing. So it's probably not the same kind of challenge as, I don't know, otherwise. Although I think they certainly know a lot about poetry and environments online, where there's a lot of online publishing, where they watch people doing spoken word poetry on YouTube. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's good things about it as mm-hmm. well.
Mm-hmm. Is the Poetry Slam as a platform, is that still vibrant?
We have a nationally ranked Poetry Slam team at New Pulse. And in fact, the Codhill Press intern this year, her name is Emily Zogby. She's the captain of the poetry team, and
wow.
she's been writing wonderful poetry. And she makes a distinction between what she calls poetry for slam and other kinds of poetry.
Hmm. It's such a bigger world now, isn't it? It's
yeah.
kind of cool. I was thinking about Susan Howe because we mentioned her earlier in regard to, she's written My Emily Dickinson, which is a definitive book.
I want to read it.
It's such a great book mm-hmm. if you're interested in Dickinson's work and her life. But Susan Howe, in and of her own self, is a really, really important and great poet. And I was just thinking of a particular book of hers, which I can't remember the title, but it's what I would call the cut and paste book, because she rearranges a lot of things somewhat, I think, intuitively, but not necessarily in a programmed way. And I was just thinking, oh, yeah, a computer would lend itself really well to the random surprise elements of cut and paste and assemblage that could create a different kind of a voice. Not intuitively based, I would say, but interesting. Do you have students that do that? Are they drawn to that?
Well, I think what's interesting is something I've noticed, and it's totally because of word processing programs. Suddenly, almost every student, the first line of the poem is capitalized because they don't want to bother changing it. But I think I mentioned this to you in one dialogue we had that, you know, what they're saying now is poetry, one of its tendencies lately is what they call elliptical. Hmm. That there are these leaps, that it's not straightforward, it's not narrative. You might just go to some absolutely surprising place. And one of the justifications I've heard about that is the fact that, yes, we're constantly mediated. We're walking down the street, we're listening to a bird, but traffic is going by and something's playing on YouTube. Mm-hmm, so you're trying mm-hmm. to patch in together. Really, you really are trying to represent reality that's different than, you know, mm-hmm. miles above Tintern Abbey and looking down and writing about this abandoned
sure.
relic.
I read a book recently about Virginia Woolf, To the River, by Olivia Lang, and she identifies one of Virginia Woolf's chief, goals or concerns is to how to capture all the six things that are happening to you at once, and how do you then present that in a narrative. And I never thought of Virginia Woolf like that, but I thought it was a really apt description. But before out of time, I want to make sure we hear some of your work. So let's talk about Starfish. This is your newest book, and just came out in 2016. Would you like to just read something? So we start with that?
Sure. So this is kind of a title poem of sorts. Elements of style. What if poets had to pick the ocean or the stars, a reputation in truth-telling or a prize in diplomacy, seabed or zodiac, water or fire, density or infinity? There's travel by Chinese junk with shipwreck or space capsule disaster, commerce or exploration, marine biologist or aeronautic engineer. Dictating rhyme, form, and meter, it's either waves as repetition or constellations as pattern, tide and undertow, or equinox and quasar. Cardinal points and horizons stay in joint custody, and every bard gets clarinets, trees, and the rigadoon. Mm-hmm. Also Spanish butterflies, mountains, and Dutch windmills.
Oh, that's lovely. Can you give us a kind of a general description of the book, of Starfish, and how it might be different from previous publications for you?
I think that, you know, again, Starfish, one of my students came in the other day and said to me, I've been reading Seahorse. And I said, really? Well, who wrote that? She said, isn't that your book? I went, no, but can I make that the title of my next book? Because it's so surreal, Seahorse. And so Starfish, you know, again, because I grew up on Cape Cod, I feel like that my two elements were the beach, the ocean, and then the stars at night above the horizon. So basically the book's in three parts, and it's mainly work about water, ocean, living by the ocean, and then what I would call the third section, which is now like living in the mountains, the landlocked section. The mm-hmm. first poem in that section is called Landlocked.
Mm.
So is it a departure? I don't know. I'm just trying to keep on. Do you know what I mean?
Keep on keeping on. Sure I do. And you brought a book by another poet.
Yes, this is by Ocean Vuong. And what's interesting about Ocean Vuong, he was born in Saigon, and he moved here as a young person. He moved here with his family when he was rather young. And he, interesting about him, one of my colleagues, his name is Christopher Jansma. He's a fiction writer, and his latest book is called Why We Came to the City. And there's a bit in it where one character says to another, can you name a poet who earns a living as a poet? And, of course, the answer is Billy Collins. And the character says, well, that's what everyone says. Well, now you can add Ocean Vuong to the list.
Oh, my.
Ocean Vuong is in his early 20s. This book was such a hit that he's out on the road. I actually booked him for New Pulse. I had to book him a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness.
Advance. He's coming in November. I'll remind you to announce it at the time.
Please.
And there is a lot of enthusiasm about him among young poets.
Yeah, I have to say, probably a month ago, I was at 192 Books in the Chelsea in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I have a friendship with a couple of people there. And I said, okay, so what should I be reading? They brought out that book. It was like with no hesitation. Night Sky with Exit Wounds. So I'm glad to see it in your hands now. And what would you like to read from it?
I'll read one poem from this. Thanksgiving 2006. Brooklyn's too cold tonight, and all my friends are 3 years away. My mother said I could be anything I wanted, but I chose to live. On the stoop of an old brownstone, a cigarette flares, then fades. I walk to it, a razor sharpened with silence, his jawline etched in smoke. The mouth where I re-enter this city, stranger, palpable echo, here is my hand, filled with blood thin as a widow's tears. I am ready. I am ready to be every animal you leave behind.
Mm. So you read and know a lot of poets. This is a new voice. What is it that's exciting to you about it?
I think what's really exciting to me about it is he is infusing kind of the diasporic experience of having been raised by parents who lived through the war years in Saigon. And he is trying to recreate in imaginative ways things from an era that he didn't live through, but mm-hmm. that's part of his heritage. He has another poem about the assassination of JFK that's told from the point of view of Jackie Kennedy. I really like the fact there's all different kinds of poems in this book. Many are elliptical. Some are like prose. Some look very traditional on the page. There's a lot of white space. It's very lyrical. So I just think it's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And anything that gets young people interested in poetry is good to me. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear another one of yours. Would you mind?
Well, I was going to read one of my students.
Oh, okay. Well,
better. I think that I really...
No, that's exciting if you brought a student poem. That's wonderful. Thank you for doing
that. You know why? Because I talked about a poem being elliptical versus mm-hmm. narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think Ocean Vuong, that was a narrative. I mean, elliptical. So here's one that's a narrative. So... This is by Paul Savigny. My brother, the zookeeper. I always wondered why you came home smelling like fresh excrement, which never bothered you, and why you borrowed my boots until they were destroyed, because you said yours were too distracting. I only found out after you ruined the third pair, thoroughly caked in tropical guanos, that you refused to wear the boots Mom bought you as a gift when you first got the job at the zoo, because they had an even number of eyelets. I'm beginning to see why you chose the zoo, the warm routine of scrubbing fish tanks, the bobcat that is a better listener than any therapist, and the easy topics for conversation, the emu that jumped the fence of its enclosure, or the wallaby that gave birth to twins. Every morning you put 31 dead chicks on a log inside the aviary with the barn owl, the Cooper's hawk, and the bald eagle. You assure me they are dead before they even arrive at the zoo. The white mice for the snake terrarium are not so lucky. In the afternoon, you stir smoothies for lemurs and marmosets, carefully mixing fresh mangoes and guava, a little vanilla yogurt to the tune of the recipe, as you hum along with the soothing static of the walkie-talkie on your hip. Recently, you've become friends with the parrots. They squawk your name and whistle sarcastic catcalls when your fine legs walk into their coop. The alpaca still spritz you with spit if you get too close. It all makes me think back to when I would visit you in the hospital, trying to make small talk about baseball or cars or the weather or anything at all as you reclined on the bed in your oversized Johnny gown the first time you tried to end your life. Because you had no control of a single thought inside the beautiful menagerie of your mind, and the world was a lonely cage.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
That is impressive.
That's better than anything I ever wrote.
Well, let's just say it's very good.
Oh, that's what I will tell you too, Robert, why I think I'm a successful teacher of poetry. I am never threatened by my students. Mm-hmm. I am never afraid that they're great writers. I hope they're better than me. It's kind of like being an Olympic coach. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You can't break the record, but you can coach someone.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, I knew it was going to be mm-hmm. great having you in the studio, and I feel that way now, and I thank you for, again,
thank
making the trip
so
down here.
Thank you so much.
Will you come back? We'd love
I
to have you again.
I would love to.
Okay. That's really exciting. Pauline Akhmanovic?
Okhmanovic. But anyway, anyone says it, I say, that's right. Thank you, Robert.
My pleasure. We're going to go out with a little Diana Ross and the Supremes.